Another way of stating that topic, you know, rhyme or reason, that's just a phrase that we all have, is this with or without rhyme or reason. What I really want to develop are some, at least an exposition of the need for moral arguments in the context of political debate relative to the protection of human life. We're all concerned in this, the public policy issue of abortion, the position of various candidates on abortion, and what we ought to be thinking about, we as a church, elaborating the moral arguments underlying the positions that we would favor as public policy decisions. Issues relating to the protection of human life can be considered in both the political and the moral order. My view is that they're getting insufficient consideration in the moral order these days. The political order embraces the relationships of the people and their government. The moral order focuses on the relationship of persons to God, truth, the good, duty, and obligation. Now, this is not to say that the political has no relationship to God, truth, the good, duty, and obligation. It's simply to emphasize that there is a distinct moral dimension to all things human, including political decision-making, and that the moral argument should be central to any discussion in or out of the political order about protection of human life. Life issues range far wider than the highly politicized abortion question. That's obvious. And that's the point of Cardinal Joseph Bernardin's long-standing effort to elaborate a consistent life ethic applicable to all life issues. But the abortion issue commands such wide interest and it ignites such intense debate that I'd like to begin these reflections with a comment about the political context of that debate, then move to a sketch of a possible position a mythical political candidate might take. And finally, I'd like to call for development of moral arguments by academics and by other intellectuals concerned about the protection of human life, arguments that are not now heard in the political debate. And perhaps the elaboration of some of those arguments could begin in the discussion that will follow this presentation. On April 5, 1992, the rallying cry for what was called a March for Women's Lives, a march in Washington, D.C., the rallying cry was, "We won't go back. We will fight back," their posters said, leaving unsaid their anticipation of Supreme Court action to narrow or overturn the permissibility of abortion on demand resulting from the court's 1973 decision in Roe versus Wade. Abortion rights and reproductive freedom is the clarion call, and it's the printed theme for political demonstrations like this one, the one that I just referred to in April of 92. Political demonstrations like that in Washington or virtually all over the country. Rights and freedom are cherished words in the American political vocabulary. They invite attention now on the part of those who elaborate and communicate a moral vocabulary. They invite special attention on the part of academics concerned about life. Throw into the mix the other politically charged word that permeates the abortion debate, namely choice. Throw that in, and you've introduced a word that has no meaning outside of a moral context, but has become a value-vacant volleyball in contemporary political discourse. Now, against this background, imagine, if you will, a political candidate seeking legislative office at the state or national level. And picture this mythical candidate facing an audience as I'm facing you and making a speech along the following lines. And I'm going to hold my hand up throughout this imaginary speech that an imaginary political candidate might make out on the hustings anywhere in this country, say a person running for Congress or running for governor or for a statewide or a national audience. This person would say, or could say, just imagine if this would happen, "I want to outline for you my political position on an issue that is at once moral and political. I also want to acknowledge that biological realities are inextricably linked to the matter I want to discuss. The issue is the destruction of unborn human life, abortion. My moral position on that issue is clear. I oppose the destruction of unborn human life as morally impermissible. My moral position rests on the principle of the inviolability of innocent human life. It is morally wrong, I believe, directly to attack innocent human life. My political position on this issue is, as I call for your support at the ballot box, my political position is one of an elected official in the legislative branch of a representative government. As such, I will be sworn to uphold and protect the Constitution of the United States. That Constitution, as interpreted by the Supreme Court in 1973 in Roe versus Wade, makes the destruction of unborn human life legally permissible to a degree often described as abortion on demand. In my judgment, the range of permissibility granted by Roe is far wider than the range of permissibility the majority of the American public would be willing to grant on both moral and legal grounds. Some Americans would be morally opposed to all abortions under any circumstances, and I count myself among them. Others would hold abortion to be morally permissible only in cases of rape or incest. Still others would extend the range of moral permissibility to cases where the pregnancy constitutes a clear threat to the life of the mother. Beyond this point, I believe the majority of the American people hold the destruction of unborn human life to be morally impermissible. Roe versus Wade does not, in my opinion, represent a consensus position of the American people. It exceeds the range of legal freedom that the American people would provide to those who want to obtain or perform abortions. More restrictive legislation is politically appropriate and, in my judgment, morally required. Not so restrictive, however, in this political democracy and pluralistic society as to run contrary to the moral convictions of the majority of the people." Now, this mythical candidate is still speaking. "My political position on this issue, therefore, is one that would support and indeed work to achieve legal restrictions on abortion to a range of permissibility that coincides with the consensus position of the American people. Moreover, just as there are elected legislators who work to extend the legal availability and permissibility of abortion, I want to work through the democratic process to bring about a reduction of the destruction of unborn human life in accordance with the consensus position based on moral conviction of the majority of the American people. I also pledge myself to work to eliminate those social conditions that some see as causative in the decision to terminate unborn human life." And this campaign speech continues, "Meanwhile, this issue calls for more reflective and articulate moral leadership aimed at bringing the national consensus as close as possible to the moral law. The moral law is, of course, interpreted and communicated by religious tradition and clarified by philosophical reflection. Both are necessary if we are to understand what it means to be human. Both, that is to say, both theological and philosophical reflection, can be helpful in identifying the basis for human rights and the presence of human personhood. Biological science can assist both theological and philosophical analysis by providing even more clarity on the crucial question of when human life begins. Legal permissibility or impermissibility should, in my view, accurately reflect the moral conviction of American society. That conviction should be shaped not by political power or shifting social forces, but rather by theological and philosophical reflection on the data of biological discovery, as well as on divine revelation and the nature of the human person. As a citizen, I would want to promote such reflection for the common good of the nation. As a legislator, I will work to serve the common good and bring the law into the closest possible conformity with the moral convictions of the people I'm elected to serve. Now, that's the end of the mythical speech, the mythical exposition of this mythical candidate's position on this volatile issue. So now, stepping down from the political platform, I want first to note that this mythical candidate is placing his or her fate immediately in the hands of the voters. Ultimately, however, the political fate of anyone willing to speak to the abortion issue in this way is in the hands of the intellectuals and the moral leaders, including pastors. The intellectuals have to lay out the moral arguments that bear on the abortion issue. The moral leaders, the pastoral leaders, have to communicate those moral arguments clearly and persuasively. This has not been happening since Roe versus Wade settled for the time the legal issue back in 1973, but left wide open the moral question. Between the legal and the moral zones of reflection, a political battleground has emerged. It's dominated by extremist rhetoric, by mindless sloganeering, and by distortion of concepts like freedom, right, privacy, and choice, as well as the notions of personhood and life itself. They have all had the philosophical ground cut out from under them over the years since Roe. What is sometimes called moral relativism is on the ascendancy. To call it moral relativism in no way implies or guarantees that moral reflection has gone before the conflicting and contradictory choices people make on human life issues. Quite the contrary. Perhaps we should call it moral agnosticism, or just acknowledge the abandonment of any semblance of conscientious choice in the way many persons alive today manage their own personal responsibilities in the area of sexuality, reproduction, child care, and respect for the dignity and bodily integrity of others. Not only has the philosophical ground been cut out from under contemporary notions of rights, freedom, and choice, but something worse has happened. We've permitted the pleasure principle to erode both the rule of reason and the sense of personal responsibility necessary for personal, political, and social stability. As a nation, we've confused the pursuit of pleasure with the pursuit of happiness. The intellectual community has now not simply an opportunity, but a clear responsibility to replace the lost ground and to fill the cultural void with reasoned moral argument. I have no credentials as an intellectual or a cultural historian to attempt a soil test of the ground that supported moral choice in other eras, in other periods of history. I suspect we entertain an illusion of firmness in the past, firmness of that ground, that simply was never there. Even when there was greater acceptance of natural law than now appears to be the case. I personally feel the times are right for a return to natural law principles and creative application of those principles as guidelines for personal choice in this present age of historical consciousness and cultural pluralism. Cultures, as I see them, are characterized by shared meanings and defined by dominant values. The intellectuals can assist in the discovery of meaning and identification of values for what they truly are. That's the work that intellectuals do. Moral leaders and pastors can communicate meanings and propose the right values for free acceptance on the part of those who populate a given culture. That's the work of moral leadership. When the right values freely accepted reside in the hearts and minds of the majority of persons in a democratic society, then a culture shift will have occurred, away from the condition of value vacancy or values that negate morality, toward values that coincide with truth. The institutions of society will rest on better ideas. The behavior of citizens will reflect their values and their own right relationship to God, truth, the good, duty, and responsibility. A writer in the Washington Post, a political columnist a couple of years ago, noted, where personal mobility and individual freedom are the most enduring values, don't expect to find a spirit of community. Let me repeat that. Where personal mobility and individual freedom, in other words, an unbridled individualism, where they are the most enduring values, don't expect to find a spirit of community. And that was a remark related to an article that was analyzing the underlying causes of the riots that occurred just days before. He wrote that in 1992, the riots in South Central Los Angeles. Now, intellectuals might profitably engage in a fill-in-the-blanks exercise aimed at identifying the enduring values in contemporary society that help to explain the legal permissibility of abortion, where X and Y and Z dominate the value scales of the majority of Americans, the intellectuals might tell us, don't expect to find a spirit of community protection for unborn human life. But those values, which would be counter values to the gospel values, where they prevail, you've got an environment that is not just permissive of, but encouraging of the destruction of unborn human life. Most Americans do in fact believe, as my mythical political candidate correctly surmised, that abortion is immoral. But many, probably a majority, also believe that every woman should be legally free to decide for herself, to choose whether to have an abortion. At this point, the political and moral orders converge. They meet on ground that awaits development of new and better moral arguments. And it's at this point that abortion can correctly be viewed as a social issue. One theft, a single theft, is not a social issue. Theft as an acceptable means of income redistribution would be a serious social issue. My decision to settle an argument by landing a fist on my opponent's jaw is not a question of social justice. Society's acceptance of violence as an acceptable, even preferred, means of conflict resolution is a question of social justice. Abortion becomes a social issue when it is no longer a matter of one woman with help from a medical professional choosing to terminate a life within her. It becomes a social issue when millions of women, with encouragement and protection from society's well-established legal and medical professions, concurrently choose to abort the life within. Then it's a social issue. And that, of course, is where the issue stands today. Society must now ask itself if this is the kind of society it wants to be, one that permits abortion virtually on demand for almost any reason. Tough questions must now be asked and answered. They will all relate to values, the values that define us as a people. Intellectuals have a role to play in articulating the questions and in developing well-reasoned answers. But reason alone will not prevail. Religious rhetoric will be needed to move the moral argument closer to the hearts of the people, to all the people, not simply or even primarily to the politicians who represent them. And that, of course, is the job of pastors, to move those moral arguments in rhetoric that can touch the heart. As Robert Bella remarked in an altogether different context, at critical moments in our history, one thinks of Abraham Lincoln or Martin Luther King Jr., we have turned to biblical language to make sense of our moral and political perplexities. Abortion in America today is both a moral and a political perplexity. Reasoned arguments wrapped in biblical language addressed directly to the people will eventually be heard in the medical, legal, and political establishments. The fact is that America today needs help in forming its conscience, which is to say, the people need help informing their consciences. Choice is first, last, and always a matter of conscience. Conscience mediates the law of God. Freedom of conscience is an important pillar of pluralism. It is never to be confused, however, with freedom from conscience. It is destructive of both pluralism and society in a so-called pluralistic, if a so-called pluralistic society permits itself to act as if conscience has nothing to do with the law of the land, and the law of the land is unrelated to the law of God. That is destructive of society. If we are to be human beings in a human society, we must be pro-moral choice on all issues. Hence, the political arena must always be open to moral argument over morally right or morally wrong choices. If, as we are fond of saying, our young people are our future, there's evidence that the acoustics will not improve in the short term for moral argument on questions of public policy. One of this nation's outstanding moral mentors, James DiGiacomo, a Jesuit who teaches, has had his apostolate in high school work over the last 35 or 40 years, he opens an essay titled Ministering to the Young with these words: open the high school classroom door a crack and listen to the following exchange between a teacher and a student. They are considering a hypothetical moral dilemma. Teacher: so those are the choices open to her. What should she do? Student: it's up to her. Teacher: yes, I know it's up to her. So what should she do? Student: it's her choice. Teacher, taking a deep breath to avoid losing his temper: Yes, we know it's her choice, but how should she choose and on what grounds? Student, it's her choice. Now, he's a veteran, as I say, of about 35 or more years of high school teaching, and he, along with other creative classroom teachers, he's used the moral dilemma to open up an inductive path of moral reasoning. State the hypothetical case, lay out the principles, identify the options, and then ask, what should the person do? Lately, the Socratic dialogue is not working. The abortion controversy, says DiGiacomo later in that essay from which I quoted the little dialogue, the abortion issue has something to do with this development. I'm quoting from him. Although there are arguments for abortion in certain circumstances, and these deserve serious consideration, many pro-abortion adults short-circuited the national debate about the rights of the unborn by calling themselves pro-choice. And so we and our children are being treated to something new under the sun, a dispute about a moral issue in which one side makes no arguments for the justice of its position, appealing instead simply to the right to choose. Thus we have, on a national scale, the same kind of frustrating non-conversation as the classroom dialogue described above. All pretense at rationality has been abandoned. The individual conscience has been pronounced infallible. In the face of an enormous and growing social evil, all that citizens can do, we are told, is to leave one another alone. Is it any wonder that our children find it difficult to engage in meaningful moral discourse? Well, now, acknowledging that Americans appear to be unwilling to engage in meaningful moral discourse on the abortion issue, we also have to wonder about our capacity as individuals and as a nation for constructive moral reasoning. To admit, as all of us should, a need for help informing our consciences is to acknowledge the possibility that not every conscientious choice is right. A moral choice can be morally wrong. The mythical candidate that I portrayed earlier has a clear moral position on abortion. It is the position of a moral absolutist. It differs from moral positions held on the same issue by others. This candidate's political position is designed to accommodate the moral and conscientious position of other persons who exercise freedom of, but not freedom from, conscience. The viability of this candidate will be strengthened by moral arguments directed to persons of moral sensitivity and conscientious choice, who can come to see the candidate's political position as respectful of their conscientiously held moral positions. The candidacy could be destroyed by conscientious critics whose moral absolutism becomes political absolutism in a political world that is, by definition, always going to be a product of the art of the possible. Political columnist David Broder, writing in the Washington Post in 1992, quotes Jeffrey Bell's comment that, quote, the setting of a society's standards is, in the final analysis, what politics is about. What is politics about? The setting of a society's standards. Broder does not disagree with this striking but not self-evident proposition, although he insists that there is a whole lot more to politics than the debate about standards. He continues, the debate can start with values, but it can't stop there. Rarely, if ever, will a political outcome reflect 100% agreement on values? That's obvious to all of us. To expect the end result of a political process to match up perfectly with the moral conviction of any one person or group, however large and influential, is unrealistic. Hence, the wisdom of devoting intellectual energy to the development of moral arguments to be used by moral leaders in their task of moral persuasion aimed at building a consensus broad enough to produce political outcomes, in other words, policies, more congenial to and consistent with the moral convictions of participating persons and groups. It would be a good investment of our intellectual energy within the church to elaborate those moral arguments and then to assist the pastoral delivery of those moral arguments so that they can hit our people where they live, right there in the heart. Academics concerned about the protection of human life in contemporary society have an awful lot of work to do. I realize that. I'm an academic. They have to clarify the philosophical foundations for any discussion of the nature of right, personhood, privacy, responsibility, and life itself in the abortion debate. The academics also have to communicate the findings of biological science along with the tenets of religious traditions. Scripture scholars in the academic community will assist by suggesting appropriate biblical language capable of conveying the moral arguments. Now, Walter Burkhardt, a well-known theologian, not a scripture scholar, but a theologian, is devoting his time these years, and he's well along in years now, devoting his time to preaching the just word, to taking the best of biblical exegesis, run it through theological reflection, and communicate it in a way that the great biblically based ideas of justice can touch our people. And it seems to me the most urgent task of all falls to a really broad range of intellectuals to do the work that I think has been largely neglected over the past 20 years. It's the articulation of the moral arguments themselves. They have been all but ignored on both sides of the abortion debate. Their appearance, now long overdue, will surely move the debate to higher ground. I think, just to say parenthetically, I think that we've missed an extraordinary opportunity over the last 20 years in the church by the leadership of the church in the United States being so properly concerned with the abortion issue that they focused so much of their energy on political strategies, and they have failed to develop stronger, more articulate, more persuasive moral arguments for doing the right thing. The higher ground will never be reached if the public debate ignores the question of whether or not the fetus is a person. Two related questions to be addressed by those who deny personhood to the fetus in any biological, philosophical, or legal sense. Two related questions would be whether life within the womb is human life, and what protection for developing human life is required on moral grounds. Now, it seems to us the answers to those questions are obvious, but those questions have to be worked out. If there were universal agreement that the fetus is, from the moment of conception, a human person, the number of citizens taking a moral stand permitting abortion would be quite small. If there were universal acknowledgement that the fetus is, from the moment of conception, human life, support for public policies permitting abortion would be significantly less than it is today. But these questions receive neither full nor fair consideration in the public policy debate on either side of the debate. The abortion debate will remain ambiguous and inconclusive if it involves nothing more than assertions and counterassertions about the presence or absence of a person or of human life in the womb. Any assertion on either side requires a willingness by the person who makes it to provide a reason why. A flat, "because I said so," or "that's how I feel about it," or "that's what the church teaches," isn't going to do it. This issue calls for convincing reasons why. Reasoned moral arguments must be advanced to address these questions and establish the baseline for political debate in which a moral society can express its will on the protection of both life and rights within the womb. My mythical candidate, and you heard his lengthy speech, he has a moral position based on the principle that it is morally impermissible directly to attack with intent to destroy innocent human life. That's a moral principle. Moving from that moral principle to a political, and remember we're talking art of the possible, community standard setting when we say political, moving from that moral principle to a political position, my mythical candidate is willing to make a political choice to reduce the incidence of abortion without legally banning abortion under any circumstance. What encouragement might such a candidate expect from those who frame and proclaim the moral arguments? What help can they provide in articulating reasons why? In other words, what help can the moral leadership, pastoral leadership, provide such a candidate in helping to articulate reasons against the clinical destruction of unborn human life? How robust will those moral arguments prove to be when and if they find their way into the political debate as expressions of support for the protection of unborn human life? How might those arguments relate to other moral arguments that weave the web of a consistent life ethic? How long or short will be the list of moral principles sufficient to inform moral choices respectful of the dignity of human life at every stage, in every circumstance? And when can we expect to achieve a national consensus on those principles? Now, these questions outline an agenda for a thinking church, an outline of an agenda for academics and other intellectuals concerned about the protection of human life. Their reflections can inform and strengthen the voice of moral leadership, and if a partnership emerges between reasoned argument and moral persuasion, politicians will have a new source of support in their struggle to be responsibly representative in circumstances of both moral and political perplexity. That, in my view, would be a remarkable achievement. Some would look for more, for some form of prophetic leadership on the part of elected officials who would move boldly out in front of the pack, unconcerned about connection to a consensus. That might work in cases of isolated, courageous, and unelected leadership, but not so easily in a representative democracy where the opportunity to serve depends on the consent of the governed, of those you wish to serve. Elected or would-be elected officials of goodwill and moral principle can be forgiven for wondering when unelected intellectuals and moral leaders are going to provide them with the need they help, the help they need, rather. Governor Robert P. Casey of Pennsylvania has long been both comfortable and outspoken in articulating his own views on this matter. At a conference on abortion and public policy at St. Louis University in March of 1993, Governor Casey said, "The question I want to address tonight is this: what are the responsibilities of a pro-life politician?" To those who would say, "I am personally opposed, but," Governor Casey would suggest consideration of the possibility that their position, in his words, confuses prudence with pragmatism and mistakes power for authority. Prudence faces up, as you know, to the political facts, but does not then fall silent. To say that because there is no consensus, nothing can be done is not prudence, but expediency, in the view of Governor Casey. His words, "Prudence compromises. It doesn't capitulate. It's tolerant, but not timid." And that is where the distinction between power and authority comes into play. Quoting Justice Byron White's characterization of the majority opinion in Roe v. Wade as an act of, quote, "raw judicial power," Governor Casey notes that it was power stripped of all moral and constitutional authority. Well, that decision, therefore, in Casey's view, is a law we must observe but never honor. Casey thinks the consensus to change that law is already here, and these are his words now, and it grows every time someone looks for the first time at a sonogram. It needs only leaders, prudent, patient leaders. It doesn't need apologists to soothe us into inaction. It needs statesmen who will work for change here and now. Now, he did not let his case rest there. He went on to list the following specific actions pro-life public officials should be taking in 1993. First, relentless, outspoken opposition to passage of the so-called Freedom of Choice Act. Second, continuous effort to expand and enlarge the protection of human life in state and national laws and policies. Third, a continuous drumbeat of public expression which makes the American people confront the facts about abortion in all of its evil. Fourth, advocacy of a new American compact in this country which seeks to involve all public and private institutions in a fight for policies and programs to offer women meaningful alternatives to abortion and to offer children and families the help they need to live decent, healthy, and happy lives. Fifth, political action which challenges both major parties and their candidates to protect human life and work for change in national elections. In summary, concluded the governor, the role of the public official must be to lead, to stand up and say to the people of this country who believe in protecting human life, press on. Well, meanwhile, the intellectuals should press on in their investigations, biological, philosophical, theological, their investigations of when human life begins and when human personhood is an actual, not potential, reality. Beliefs rooted in religious convictions will not fail anyone holding those beliefs when it comes to deciding what is morally right and wrong in the matter of abortion. But assertions will fail in trying to convince others. One cannot merely assert a belief and expect that assertion to be persuasive for someone whose convictions are rooted in different soil. Moral argument can, however, become persuasive for anyone with an open mind, anyone who is open to receive the moral argument. In my opinion, a critical juncture in the dialogue and eventual debate over the morality of abortion is the early point of agreement or disagreement on vocabulary. Is the debate about terminating the life of a human person? If not a human person, is it human life? If not human life, what is it? Fertilized egg, zygote, embryo, fetus, child, what is it? When does it become a person? How can this life be said not to be human life at any stage of intrauterine development? If it is human life, does it have no rights? The vocabulary of choice, unattached to other words that define the choice, enables one to avoid the issue. And that, in fact, is what we've been doing in this debate. Assumptions have to be explicit. Does the abortion choice involve the termination of a human person, a human life, living cells on the way to becoming human life? What is that which is terminated? By what right does a person decide to effect the termination? Certainly not simply by an undefined right to choose. What rights are resident in the living entity which, because of the abortion, will cease to live? Are the rights under discussion natural and thus inalienable, or civil and thus subject to change? Governor Casey's fourth point, the call for a new American covenant, puts the question on a broader social justice agenda. And that makes sense politically and morally. It also challenges all of us, but particularly intellectuals and the thought leaders in the church. It challenges us to build the arguments with the social justice linkages in mind, as it suggests to moral leaders the wisdom of strengthening their pro-life advocacy with the persuasive force of a coherent protection of life argument applicable to all humans of all ages and in all stages of life. Well, there it is. That's some of the rhyme and some of the reason, but it sets an agenda that has to be continued by all of us who are really committed to doing something about this widespread evil in contemporary society with which we coexist. Thanks. Yes, sir.
Father, I want to thank you for that presentation. I've often wondered why I've personally found it very difficult to get up and speak about abortion from the pulpit. And I think you've helped me to find a reason in my own life, because I don't have the vocabulary in many ways to articulate it, or the arguments to articulate it as well as I would like to. And so I want to thank you for that. It's going to make me go back and do some more homework. Thank you.
Thanks. And it's also, you know, as you said, to speak from the pulpit. When we speak from the pulpit, whenever we speak from the pulpit, I shouldn't overgeneralize, but ordinarily when we speak from the pulpit, we should always be extending the proclamation that's there in the text before us. So it's often inappropriate to speak about abortion from the pulpit. That is not to say we shouldn't speak about abortion, nor is it to say that we couldn't select some texts on a particular occasion, say on a pro-life Sunday or on a day of some rally, select some texts that give us the opportunity to extend that proclamation in the direction. I think people find it offensive, not on the abortion issue necessarily, all of that would be included, when people just get up and start banging away at the pulpit and you know, give them a lecture on something that's really unrelated. We've got to be a little more sophisticated about it, acknowledging that there is a time for an occasional sermon, but ordinarily it calls for a homily, and the homily is to be an extension of the proclamation. Yes?
I think that along with the same line, Father, that maybe pastors could use more of their pastor's columns and bulletins and the resources in my parish, which is a rural parish. We happen to have a surgeon who is on our pro-life committee, and he has even a billboard that he puts up appropriate things on that level to explain. But the fact that we have such a active pro-life parish, and yours truly as pastor, on those appropriate occasions, and I realize what you're saying about haranguing and never giving up the topic, on those appropriate occasions, I can see that it stirs up within the soul of some people who are Catholic, who have been going to church and have just fallen into the other camp, because they are molested by the fact that the church, it's visible. You cannot go into our parish and not know that this, among other important social justice issues, the way we treat our migrant farm workers, who are very much alive and awake in my parish, the way the pastor has gotten blasted for giving too much attention to them and other things like that, to the fact that you'll even get in the collection plate nasty notes.
Sure.
Why do we hear about this? Why do we have that billboard about abortion? Don't they know? Doesn't Father Kelly know this is 1994? And so I found that your idea of prudence is very good. On the other hand, I realize that I'm never going to be without, or anybody else who's working on such a issue, whether it's justice for Haiti or treating other Catholics in the parish in a just way. I'm going to get off the wing.
No,
here.
This is
I'm
good.
Rambling too much, but on other those that whole web of life idea, I can see. I had a First Communion teacher 3 years ago. First Communion wouldn't accept the Mexican students in there in her class. Reasons, anything that she could pull out. They don't understand English too well, and they're coming from a different culture. She had a whole slew of them every time, and she wound up with 12 students in the class and three of them Mexican-American. I said, I'll make up a name. I said, Priscilla, they speak better English than I do. It's their parents you may not communicate with their parents. Leave that to me.
Yeah.
And she left the parish, left the church in disgust because we had. I got off the track, but I think that it's a problem. Somehow or another, people are simply don't want to extend in any field out of the comfortableness of something.
Yeah, you're right.
I don't even think it's a matter of seeking justice and rights for women, let them have a choice. I think that some have left that direction.
Well, I think we have lost respect for life in all its forms. The way we drive automobiles, the way we celebrate violence in films and entertainment, the way even our sports emphasize violence. There is a question of respect for the human life that's there. Go back to the example of the teacher who wouldn't take the Mexican kids. And of course, I don't know who she is, and this is all hypothetical. But let's assume that she said, I am pro-choice. And you could say, well, so am I. I am pro every moral choice possible. Now, tell me, what is the moral reason on which you rest the exclusion of the Mexican children from your class? Elaborate for me the moral reason. Similarly, if she were to get into an argument with you about abortion and says, I'm pro-choice, you say, so am I. I'm pro-moral choice. Now, relative to abortion, what is the moral reason behind the choice that you're advocating? And she may just say, because I've got a right to choose. And, you know, you get into this value-vacant discussion. But I think without humiliating or ridiculing people, I think to put it on that ground, you're doing that person a service. And I think pastorally we have to do that. Because as you know, often there are pastoral situations where you're not going to override a position of conviction, conscientious conviction, well considered by a well-formed conscience of somebody who might disagree with what you think that person ought to do. You can't force them to do anything. But see, what we haven't done on the abortion issue, and indeed we don't do it on many other issues, is invite people to articulate the moral grounds on which they're taking those positions. Yeah, you wanted to.
I just want to share a few things. I know the church often uses the expression culture of death. Huh?
Culture of death.
Yeah, I didn't hear that in your paper.
Yeah.
Another thing, I thought you could have brought out the impact of feminism. They have tremendous impact on this whole abortion issue, as far as I know.
Well, okay, but then when you say feminism, that's a very general term. And you have to, I mean, there is no univocal content to that word feminism.
Okay. But they're there.
There are some feminists who are pro-life. There are some feminists who are pro-choice. But feminism as such doesn't have a content, except that it puts the accent on things that are of interest to women.
I thought maybe that the abortion issue was a rallying point for their feminism.
Some try to make it a rallying point. The National Organization of Women would try to make it a rallying point. in Washington, Catholic universities in Washington now will try to get some of the kids on those universities interested in these things so they can wear an NOW t-shirt. They do use it as a rallying point.
Another point is the big money in abortion. Huh? That could also be brought out. It's a $1 billion business. And that's also one reason, I think, why it'd always be supported by big business.
Well, you say big business supports abortion?
Well, no, I said it's money, money-making, $1 billion.
Well, there are a lot of physicians. I presume those who are performing the procedures get paid for it. I guess some individuals who do nothing but that would make a pretty good living at it.
I'm just using that as an incentive. Huh?
Yeah.
What would keep a lot of them,
Yeah.
Pro-abortion.
Yeah.
The last thing I want to share with you, I work in Africa, and I make video productions. And about 4 years ago, I took a 20-minute American production done by a priest in Chicago called Abortion, A Woman's Decision. And we took this production and we rewrote it in an African context. And it took about a year to do. And we had 5 medical doctors assisting us. And we did it in the language of Kiswahili. And that production has gone throughout all of East Africa. And I think it was far more powerful than all the arguments you'd get from a sermon, a Sunday sermon or the moral arguments. Just seeing the drama unfold, huh? The only thing, the difference between our production and that in Chicago was, he called his production Abortion, A Woman's Decision. And we called ours, Please, I Beg You, Do Not Kill Me. And translated into the Kiswahili language was very graphic. And I was told that by many doctors have used this. They said it saved thousands of girls from having an abortion. Just a drama impact. And many of the moral teachings were in the context of that production. So I just want to suggest that.
Sure. Well, I think that's Casey's point about the sonogram. You look at the sonogram, you're going to change your perspective about terminating life within.
Well, there was a Jewish doctor who did several of those productions. They were very, very good for the educated people, I think, huh? But to the common person, it was over the head. That was my experience. Huh?
Is abortion a widespread problem in Africa?
Oh, yes, yeah. Every country of the world, and the money is coming from the States, and they've been propagating it for years and years. Huh? And it's very attractive. The other arguments they use, they say, well, if you don't legalize abortion, then you have this backstreet abortion. That's one of their favorite arguments, too.
Sure,
huh? And those arguments, pro-choice and backstreet abortion, are very convincing for a lot of people, huh?
Sure.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, I guess that ends this one, and we'll see you when. 10:45, half hour from now.